Tell a story about the zero.
Oh. I wish I had the book. I didn't print that out. Dad was flying over one of the islands, and he looked down, and the Americans were stationed on these islands with the Aussies and a lot of other people, the Canadians and everybody else, the Cactus Air Force, which was from Texas and was the most decorated unit in the South Pacific. And he happened to fly over an airfield, and he saw a Japanese Zero parked on the tarmac. And he thought, wow, I wonder how that got there. I'm going to go down and find out. So he circles around, he lands, and there were a bunch of people looking at the plane. And so he asked them, he said, you know, is this plane operational? And they said, yes, go talk to the Aussie lieutenant in the house there. Dad said, fine. So he went in, he asked the Aussie lieutenant, you know, was it possible that he could take the plane up for a spin? And they said, sure. So the Aussie lieutenant says, but do you have a chute? And said, Dad said, yeah, I've got one. So Dad goes out, climbs up into the plane, except he finds out he and the chute can't fit in the plane. So he says, well, I don't really need the chute. He takes the chute off. He gets in the plane. Now, my dad was 6'2", tall and skinny, and he folded himself up like a pretzel trying to get into that plane, but he was still too big, couldn't get the door closed, couldn't get in position. Finally said, well, you know, let me get down on my knees. He literally got down on his knees and decided he'd use the stick with one hand and work the foot pedals with his other hand. And he said he looked outside the window, and a crowd had gathered outside, and people were laughing so hard, he said some people had fallen down on the coral tarmac. And it was then that he realized that there was no way that he was going to be able to fly that Zero because he was just too big. The Zeros were built for the Japanese, who were 5'1" or 5'2" or shorter. And he said he began to realize that everybody knew before he even got in there he was never going to be able to fly that plane, and they were just waiting for him to figure that out.
It was a setup.
So but I, one of the things that Dad did that I would like to read you, because it's such
while she's looking there, I got the opportunity to meet her dad.
Yeah.
1 year up here, we had the Tuskegee Airman, and I think he's an honorary member, is he not?
Yes, he's... he was a member of the Chicago chapter, and they basically grandfathered him in because he had flown with 14 Tuskegee trained.
I speak of him, you know, as being here with us because
right.
He is today.
Right.
Yeah, just like my brother's here who passed away last year.
Yeah.
His spirit is here today.
Dad's here somewhere.
Anyway, I got to meet her dad. We had 8 Tuskegee Airmen up here. Her dad was one of the guys I interviewed, and one of the other people here was a doctor who was kind of their escort around here, a black doctor, and he was from the Chicago area, I think, and me. So we had 10 chairs up here, and I opened up the program with, there are 10 pilots up here. We all were pilots. I said, do you see any difference in anybody? And I was the only white guy up there. Everybody in the crowd shook their head no, because up here in Oshkosh, we're all the same. Don't you think?
I agree. Well, you'll get a kick out of this little short passage I'm going to read you here. This is from his chapter 13, Welcome to the War. One of the things that Dad did, the upside of being in the South Pacific was he got to do a lot of sightseeing, as other pilots have said. You get great views from the air in these low and slow planes. What Dad did was he decided to play tour guide, because the Army and Navy pilots, fighter pilots, were fascinated by Dad's L-4. They just had never seen anything like that before. They couldn't quite figure out what it was doing in a war zone. How could this possibly be a combat aircraft? And so Dad sort of got the last laugh. Let me read you what he did. He says, I visited Henderson Airfield while flying around the island and ran into both Army and Navy fighter pilots while there. I suspected that few of them had ever seen a Piper Cub, and that probably contributed to the fact that they sometimes invited me to swap planes with them. I rarely took them up on their offers. Their planes were much more powerful and more complicated than mine, and it was just easier to invite them to fly with me. I had 2 seats and dual controls. The fighter pilots were delighted to accept my offer, but they were surprisingly nervous co-pilots. They couldn't believe that a mere 65-horsepower engine really was an engine, and they doubted that my little plane was a legitimate fighting machine. I had to remind them that when I gave the word, 12 155-millimeter howitzers spoke with one voice. Not even a squadron of bombers could wreak the havoc those guns could inflict. So playing tour guide, I flew my guest co-pilots around the island, flying them along beaches where many Japanese ships had made their ultimate stop. I did my best to keep my guest co-pilots entertained during my tours, but one Navy fighter pilot just couldn't stop focusing on the features missing from my L-4H. He expressed concern for my safety in such a plane, but I suspect that what really concerned him was his own safety while in it. He noticed, for example, that the seat back and bottom of my L-4H were not armor-plated, that the gas tank was not self-sealing if hit by a bullet, and that minus a pressurized fuel line, I couldn't fly upside down. Those were standard features on the planes he flew, and without them, he was positively unnerved. "So what happens if a Japanese Zero spots you?" he wondered out loud. Rather than respond, I decided it was time for a private demonstration of Air Safety for Liaison Pilots 101. In other words, I flew him over the coastal mountain range, plunged into a mountain ravine, clipped treetops with my wheels as I descended to the ocean, and flattened out just 5 feet above the water. The Navy fighter pilot threw up. Class over.
Well, I've been told that it's time to sum it up, Karen. I just want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've enjoyed it immensely. And before we do wind it up here, all you veterans, we have a gift for you after this program. So come up and see me. I want to shake your hand and find out which branch of service you were in. And we have a nice gift for you. All you veterans do that after the program. Karen, sum it up. What does all this mean coming up here and honoring your dad today?
Well, it's just that. I am here. I'm honoring my dad. I know he is here somewhere. He doesn't miss Oshkosh. I don't care whether he's dead or alive. He's here, and I can be sure of that. And I just would love to have you guys read his story in his own words. He has many, many stories in his book. I'll be selling it over in the Warbirds bookstore. You can find out not only about all the aerial misadventures he had in his L-4H, and he had quite a few. It's amazing that he survived the war to have me. But you could also find out about what my dad called fighting the Civil War, little C, little W, which was what the African-American pilots had to face serving in a segregated army during World War II. There were many racial incidents on bases, and in fact, one last story I'll tell is of my father finding out that his paycheck was being docked $25 a month for membership to the officers' club on Guadalcanal. And so he and some of the other black officers headed over to the officers' club one day, only to be turned away at the door because they were African American. And Dad said, "But wait a minute, we've been paying our dues every month. You know, go tell the commanding officer, we've paid all our dues." And so the corporal said, "Fine." He went in, came back out a few minutes later and said, "Sorry, the rule stands." Ultimately, my father was so upset about this, he decided to write a letter of protest to the Judge Advocate General's office, the JAG office. And to figure out how to do it without getting court-martialed, he consulted a friend of his who was not yet a lawyer, hadn't passed the bar. The war had interrupted his legal education, but he was a lawyer from Howard University in Washington. And Judge George Layton, who became a big-time judge in Chicago, they just named the county courthouse after him a couple of years ago. Anyway, George told him, "All right, I like the letter you've written, but here are a couple of things. One, I can't sign it with you because if two people sign it, the Army will consider us to be fomenting a conspiracy or, you know, colluding." So he said, "I can't sign it with you." And my dad said, "Well, how do I keep it from getting tossed in the wastebasket?" And George said, "Well, you're going to put a little P.S. at the bottom. You know, please wait for the original to come through channels." And he said, "You're going to send it to your commanding officer, who will have to send it to his commanding officer, and on up the chain of command." so that they know that there are at least two copies and that everybody in the chain of command has seen them. And he said, that way you'll be able to get the letter to the person who can make the decision about what to do with the officers' club without getting court-martialed. So that's what they did. And I'm sorry to say that instead of deciding to let the black officers in the officers' club, they closed it down. And yep. That was what life was like in 1942 if you were a black pilot. It didn't matter, you know, how well you flew your plane or anything else. You know, you were colored first. That's what they called people then. And that was what took precedence. So my father has a lot of stories about dealing with that, too. He said he took to the air, and that's how he managed to cope. But it was tough. But these guys fought for their country very proudly and served the country well. And I thank you very much for hearing me out.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present my new friend, Karen Taylor.